doesn't mean that I don't care. It means I'm partially there. You're gonna need to be patient with me.
Wilco on Planet Waves FM, the voice and the guitar of Jeff Tweedy. The word Wilco is late World War II radio slang. It's a portmanteau of the words will comply. An interesting concept in our time. You are listening to Planet Waves FM, the Tantra Studio portion of this program, which has been a bit occasional lately in this season of the show, though one of our long-term and focused listeners, Nicole, sent me this interview with Kelly Brogan, conducted by a guy named Saul Luckman. I believe his program is called Uncensored. I've linked to it, so you can listen to the full hour. I'm only going to play little samples and comment on them. Kelly Brogan is a holistic psychiatrist, so she's a medical doctor. She went through the full, indoctrination into psychiatry, the fine school, as Bob Dylan said, and then started to have certain life experiences that changed her and awakened her to certain elements of medical reality, and got sick with, I believe, Hashimoto's disease, and then was able to heal herself using natural methods. And now her psychiatry practice is dedicated to helping people heal naturally without the use of these horrendous pharmaceuticals provided by the same companies that make the COVID shot. And she is partners with a man named Sayer G. I adore the two of these people, though I've never met them or spoken with them. This interview so impressed me that I thought I have got to work with this as material for Tantra Studio, because there's some things you're going to hear in, we'll get there. So I have promised to begin each Tantra Studio with a definition, with my definition of Tantra. There's a lot of definitions going around, and depending on people's training and what books they've read and all that stuff, there's a lot of different ideas. I have a very simple concept of what Tantra is. And that is a study in experience in life that uses sex and sexuality as its primary metaphor. So it's not so much about sex for its own sake or sexual technique or all that, as it is about understanding that sex and sexuality and sexual relationships are a set of metaphorical references. We may live physically in some ways and may live emotionally or mentally in many other ways. That is a kind of model of existence. So that's why I say that it's an existential study. It's not, in my view, about pujas and bindis and all this stuff, delaying ejaculation or that kind of stuff, as it is about understanding life, understanding yourself, understanding the way that you relate to people, with perhaps an a priori concept that sexuality is everywhere, and that one of the things that our society does, and many societies do this, his attempt to suppress, control, and regulate not only the behavior of people, but the thoughts they think and the ideas they share, the art that they make, and the things that they say. Though it is not presented as such, one of my favorite works, by favorite I mean one of the ones that's been the most instructive to me in this journey that describes the problem that I think that tantric study might be inclined to help resolve. It's called Eros Denied by Wayland Young. Another one of the masterpieces that was published the year that I was born. It was quite a year, 1964. And Eros Denied by I think the fifth Baron Kennett or Wayland Young. He gave up his peerage. Is a quite beautiful history of particularly what the Christians did to sex, and he makes it fairly plain from a historical standpoint that of all the world religions, by far, the Christians are the most hostile to sex and sexuality. And when anything is hostile to sex and sexuality, it is by default hostile to women. So often when we say sex, we mean women. And if it is not apparent, even from the least contact with conventional churchianity, it is not friendly to either of these things, and much is festered in the corners and in the shadows. Okay, so that's my concept of tantra, the living metaphor of sexuality as it relates to existence and the study of existence. And here, Kelly is brilliant. I wasn't sure what to make of this interview the first time that I heard it. It seemed a little stiff in a way, but then I kept listening. And the three passages you're about to hear, I've listened to quite a few times and, make sure I'm really following what she's getting at. And if you find them interesting, I suggest that you, listen to the full hour, because she covers many topics in what is, I think, a genuinely daring, daring presentation. And I would remind us all that sexual speech is all but forbidden. And I don't mean forbidden so much by law. The law is much more lenient and generous than custom, than culture, than the rules that people make an attempt to enforce upon one another. And in the current highly politically charged atmosphere that surrounds sexuality, all you're really allowed to talk about right now are, I think, three things: rape, LGBTQ with an emphasis on T, right? Gay rights, trans rights, rights, more legal, political, and how wonderful monogamy is. Pretty much everything else can subject a person to various shades of cancellation, Rotten Tomatoes, and the first stone being cast at them. So let's jump right into, now after I've been talking for 8 minutes in this segment, let's jump right into Kelly and her first quote and give that a listen. Here's Kelly Brogan.
A sort of convergence of unexpected forces, right? So like for me, for example, getting very, very clear on the energetic coherence of my no. I'm Italian Irish, I got a big mouth, and I know how to say no. I've been a rebellious, kid since I was probably like one. And nonetheless, there are so many areas of my life where I have that mealy mouth sort of like half yes, half no, no please, no maybe, you know, and a lot of it is around my relationship. You know, like I got off my smartphone in December, that felt big. I still shop on Amazon. That feels shameful. You know, right. I, you know, started to grow my own food and, you know, integrate my relationship to animals. And, you know, all of this work had to be done before I can stand in a no that does not require explanation, validation, protest, or anything else, because the pillar of power that that simple one word of energy contains is its own defined field. But then what is my yes, right? And so most of my work recently has been on in the erotic realm, actually. And I have like coaches and, you know, body workers and people that I am recruiting to support my relationship to my own erotic energy. And the reason that I, in the midst of Rome burning, have decided, you know, to focus on expanding that dimension of my human experience is because I do believe it may be the antidote. I do believe that this is a, you know, it's a frequency that is largely inaccessible, if not entirely inaccessible, to those who are, you know, we're playing this game with, and that it is extremely defiant in a way that is, that feels very sovereign to me. You know, like I remember I was listening to this therapist I used to see, Esther Perel, who does a lot of, you know, sex and couples therapy work. And she was speaking to one of her patients in a recorded audio. And this patient had experienced sexual abuse. And she was talking about the kind of reclamation that you experience when you have erotic intimacy with a partner, when you have a history of sexual abuse, is the ultimate empowerment, right? It's the ultimate fuck you. It's the ultimate, you know, you did not, you cannot, and you will not take this from me. I still have it. And you can't take it, right?
So Marvin Gaye was right all along.
Yeah.
We just need sexual healing.
Exactly. And, you know, it's not, the work that I'm doing is not necessarily partner-based. You know, it's about intimacy with my own energy field, the yin and yang within me, right? The masculine, feminine within me, really getting to know, you know, my body, really getting to know what it is that I call, you know, pleasure and preference, bringing a playful energy into, you know, the shrapnel laden battlefield, that charnel ground. And so I, you know, that's just an idea I've had recently, is that these kind of unexpected energies that we can bring into play may.
I'm not sure what the continuation there is. So many thoughts. You know, okay, hold on. I'll go to, okay. So much in here. This thought, I think, begins with her, first of all, acknowledging the exploration of no and yes. In the currently acceptable politicized discourse, so-called, around sexuality, all you're allowed to say is that no means no. How many times have you heard people say that? No means no, no means no, no means no. That's all very nice. However, there is no no without yes somewhere. There is no yes without no somewhere. They're complementary concepts. And one cannot live by no alone, right? To get to California, you need the gas and the brakes and the steering, but you need the yes of the gas and the no of the brakes. And you stop at the right time and you go at the right time. And that's how you get across the country or across the universe. So yes and no. And she gives an example maybe later in the interview of when she feels like she betrayed herself by not just saying, no, don't want to do that. Thanks a lot. Then she describes something that, you know, immediately made my ears perk up. And she says that one of her most you know, like pressing involvements now. One of her most like dedicated involvements right now is exploring her own erotic energy field. She's using kind of new age language rather than plain talk. And I understand why, because plain talk can get people in trouble. And also, when you're at that, and I can say because I've been there a few times, when I've been at that space of broaching this conversation in public, you're not sure if you're slipping into a cold bath full of ice cubes or a warm bath full of wholesome soap bubbles. And so to find the right language is challenging. But what I heard her say is that she is working with others, coaches, body workers, and others who are helping her to explore her own erotic energy and get to know her body and her preferences. This to me sounds like masturbation practice. The what I describe as the tantra of masturbation, pretty much upon which this entire series of presentations is based, and all of Book of Blue is based on that. And so those who have met me or have read my stuff are familiar with this approach that I've taken. And my ears perked up because this is a person of tremendous cultural stature saying this now. And she's not saying it as a Betty Dodson, hi, this is what I do. She's saying it in the wider context of all she's doing. And she said something that also really got my attention, which is that she suspects that this may be the antidote to all that we are seeing going on. And I would say, you're onto something there. Because ultimately, all of this insanity that we are seeing and all of this self-destructive behavior, people being induced into suicidal behavior, is all based on disembodiment. It's based on alienation from the body. It's based on guilt and shame about the body. It's based on the idea that the body is a disease vector and nothing else. That in Course in Miracles terms, it's about the belief in sin. And that's what holds all of this madness together. This guilt, shame, fear, complex is like what everything's made of in this world. And as I've suggested before, it's one of the reasons why Tantra takes so seriously the need to work with embarrassment rather than against embarrassment. Because to work with embarrassment is to move into the forbidden territory to find out what's there. And what is there are almost invariably the deeper pleasures and the deeper healing. Now, speaking of healing, one of the kind of like struggles I've had in describing sexual healing is the question, where do you go for it? Who do you go to? Who do you ask for help? What do you read? Who's right? Well, it's possible to find help. It's possible to find the thing that's right for you. And it's possible to get out of the woundology paradigm of I'm so wounded. I'll never be well. I'll never experience this no matter what. I'm in pain. And what she says toward the end of her this first few minutes is about those who refuse to let their previous sexual trauma interfere with their ability to have the sexual intimacy that they want. And this is integral to another idea, which is that the healing comes through embracing pleasure, intimacy, and surrender. So the healing is not done like repairing a car. It's not a thing that can necessarily be fully worked out in therapy or psychiatry or psychology, but can be prepared for. Ideas can be had and understandings can be had in those processes, but ultimately it's what you do with your feelings and your body, your emotions, and with what you choose to share with others that is where you actually find the healing process, the healing experience, where you realize you're free, which is what I mean by healing. You realize you're free and you're fine and you have, you're in the present, not constantly trapped in one trigger after the next. But to get there, one last thing before we play the next segment. She's being clear when she says it's not necessarily partner experiences. She means she's doing some form of solo exploration, but what she's describing as assisted solo exploration. So we've talked many times about the witness, the thresholder. It sounds to me like she's found a few thresholders to work with who can hold the space and serve as guides and who know how to create a place where this kind of internal alchemical experience, this flourishing or releasing or surrender or learning or experiencing, what all of the above can actually happen. And I think that what she's hinting at here is a model of sexual healing that I think cannot be said often enough. I personally don't think, well, there's different things in different situations, but what my understanding is that there are a great many people who will benefit from taking their sexual journey inwardly, solo, but this is not antisocial solo. This is witnessed. This is assisted by thresholders, by experienced people who have been there. And there are many. Most of them are aware of the work of my friend and teacher and eternal astrology client, Betty Dodson. All right, and she's the one who starts this. She's the one, by the way, Betty's the one who brings this into the culture in books and articles and illustrations and talks and videos and workshops and every possible format. This conversation was not happening prior to the contribution of Betty Dodson. It is not easy to point to any one major subject and say, well, there really was one originator. There was one person who tossed the pebble into the pond and made the first ripple. That was Betty Ann. Okay, here's a couple more minutes of Kelly speaking, and then I'll tell you what I think. Okay, here we go.
I just have so many thoughts, unfolding because this has been a space that I've been deeply occupying recently, even in my own shadow work, because I have, I think most of us are conditioned to feel there is something deeply unlovable at our core, right? And my flavor of that has been, an identification with something like the Medusa archetype, right? That I have this dark energy in the core of myself that is highly destructive and that is irrepressible, right? So I open my mouth, I destroy things, I speak my truth, people hate me.
Kelly the Destroyer.
And fundamentally, this archetype can dress herself up, and it's actually part of, embodying the archetype is you get gifted, beauty and charisma and all the things, so you can hide that ugly, core self, that dark witch inside. And I have spent the greater part of my, adult life feeling like no one actually could possibly love me. It's not actually possible because it's like I'm made of knives, right? And if they went to hug me, I would cut them up, So how could they possibly love me? And as I have come into a deeper intimacy with myself, I'm getting to a place where I can begin to, you know, embrace this aspect of who it is that I feel I am and be okay, you know, with the fact that others may not show me, you know, what it is that I am starting to feel for myself. Because previous to that, it would feel so painful, especially in partnership, you know, if I would be reflected that I have these ugly parts that are like everybody wishes would stay in the closet, you know, so I just keep the pretty parts out. And reinforce this split for me. But in order to inhabit a world, you know, that holds the destructive energies so that the creative energies can, you know, play their very specific role, that sort of equal playing field, like the embrace of both, is essential. And it probably starts with a relationship to ourself. You know, I was thinking just today how self-betrayal and the resolution of self-betrayal, but at least the awareness of the moments in which we do it, right? So I was just getting my car cleaned while I was at a dance class before this interview. There's this like guy who, you know, cleans the car by hand in the back of the dance studio. And I was going to be late for this interview because he was like too detail oriented and taking forever, like wiping all these things I don't care about. Okay. As long as there's not like crumbs on the seat, I'm good. So he said, okay, give me like 5 minutes, but I didn't really have 5 minutes. And I was like, okay. That little experience, I watched myself betray myself so that I could maintain some sort of amicable connection to this stranger, pretty much. I said, okay, when it actually wasn't okay for me. Right? These little instances of self-violation create this very unstable foundation for understanding who it is that we are. And then we perceive all that is outside of us through that limited understanding of who it is that we are. So we, in my worldview, we project all of these unsavory aspects of self on the outside, right? So if I have not yet embraced this Medusa within, then you better believe I'm going to experience and fight with it on the outside. And that, I think, is the invitation, right? To really focus our energies on the inside while maintaining sufficient awareness of the environment and what it is continuing to reflect to us.
Utterly brilliant. Okay. I feel like I need a transcript of this to break it down like phrase by phrase, but let's work from the last part of that backward. She's talking about the split, which can manifest many, many ways, and that when there is not self-integration and self-acceptance and true self-love, that the split is projected into relationships, generally onto the partner. And that creates this perpetuation of a drama, but then the actual inward condition is not addressed. Because it seems like an externally experienced situation, which she very aptly describes as being part of her environment, right? The relationship, seventh house in astrology, it's the relationship and it's the normal waking consciousness environment. All the houses are environments. The seventh is the most environmental in that it is just what you see when you're walking down the street, basically, or looking at someone. So she's saying, take the journey inward and heal the split, address the healing, the need for healing of the split inwardly. So we now have another layer of detail when we talk about sexual healing. When we talk about sexual healing, what I think we really mean is the healing of an internal split, an internal division, one being turned against oneself, which many, many experiences in life do this. They turn us against ourselves. And then that itself is internalized, and then and it just can go on for a long time, and you don't really hear ideas like this spoken very often. And Kelly is saying what I could have not quite been able to get into words. I find it easier to express this stuff through art and photographs and relating the direct experiences in writing. So she describes the split as the inner Medusa, the dark witch. Later you'll hear her describe it as the evil mother, I think. And needing to make peace with that internal entity, right, with this destroyer type entity, such that she can express her creativity. We're really at the essence of the matter here. And the reason that this needs to be done, in I think in my view, right, this is all my opinion, my perspective, my experiences, and I'm pretending to elaborate on what Kelly is saying here. I have true to this idea, but here's my take, is that when we attempt to do this in particularly dyadic, but any relationships, pair bonded people, there is so much volatility that it is almost impossible not to project onto the partner and then lose the thread, lose the plot completely, because the plot is about healing an inner split. And so it's not that easy in this world of Maya to see that person one's projecting on as that. Projection is an unconscious process. That's the definition out of Jung. It's unconscious, and it's always about projecting shadow. And I think, that's what he said. I think it can also be about, projecting goodness, but generally, and in Jung's terms, projection is about the unconscious projection of shadow onto other people. Oh my God, they're so evil, or that person is this or that, or they hate me, or whatever it may be. And when this is taken inward, that projection has to be called back and integrated. And so the reason to not do this with, you know, the conventional concept of a partner is it's very much given to that projection just being right in the dynamic, and the people that you're working with need in a sense to be disinterested parties, not disinterested in your well-being, but and your healing process. Obviously they've devoted themselves to that purpose, assuming that they really have, but rather not having any skin in the game in terms of how you feel about them. Someone in a true thresholder role doesn't take personally what you say, and they are there to consciously serve as a mirror. So I talk about this in the in an edition of Tantra Studio about the thresholder and the mirror. It's currently on the front page of Planet Waves FM, that the role of the thresholder is to provide a space holding, a facilitating role, and a role of holding the mirror, more so than unconsciously becoming the mirror. It's very hard to project onto a person who's sitting in front of you holding a mirror to your face and saying, here, look at yourself, face yourself, have an experience. What do you need to say to yourself? What do you feel? What do you want? What are your fears? What are your needs? What are your desires? That mirror serves as a space defining and a purpose and a relationship defining tool that makes plain what's going on in projection. And the mirror is, I think, a psychological tool, and it's also an erotic tool. It's all on the same spectrum. Because using a mirror, you have the ability to really study yourself as you go through different facets of your emotional response and your sexual response, and to do something that many people find to be impossible, which is to hold eye contact with yourself while you're orgasming. And to stay in full contact communication with yourself. And I have found that that it helps to do this with someone, and then alone, and then with someone, and then alone, because there's the experiences play off of one another, and there's degrees of intimacy that you'll experience with yourself when someone is there, making it easier, and then there's another element of intimacy with yourself that you will experience when you're alone and have that kind of scrim of privacy. Of course, much of this is about dissolving projection, and then that can be about dissolving your inner denial of your own being, your own feelings. And if we're talking about making friends with the Medusa, the Dark Witch, the Evil Mother, whatever it might be, once you are relating to that inside yourself, well, that's the beginning of a conscious relationship. That's the beginning of a process, and it is implicit in that an element of denial is taken away. Oh, that is something that I contain. As for it being core self, that I think anyone who's actually experienced core self has not found it to be an evil mother, dark witch, or Medusa, but rather a genuinely loving internal presence that can be modeled by the thresholder. When I say thresholder, I often mean the person holding the mirror. That what the person holding the mirror is doing is modeling the inner compassion that you can experience for yourself by demonstrating that while you are in a space to decide whether or not you want to be compassionate with yourself. And in terms of the depth of the sexual experiences that might be involved, what I have found is that these deepening sexual experiences become love making. There's a sense I've often have of like backing myself into a corner where the only thing I can do in that space is love. Now, in terms of who's on one side of the split and who's on the other side of the split, there are a lot of ways this can manifest. And I have used the split in my writing, in my description of my own experiences a great many times, often to describe the different state of consciousness on either side of orgasm. And some people, it is radically different. Some people can have the most incredible orgasms and be in such a loving space with themselves and others, and then the guilt and shame and distraction can rush in a way that's very invasive. So that's one part of the split. So that's like, well, what's the gap? How do we work on that gap? And my approach has been to work with thresholders. They have included various forms of body workers. The women that I work with now are top rate body workers, but they either have an innate gift or I have taught them thresholding. And it's very simple. It's holding space. And there are people who just get this. It is, yes. Now I have found in my experience that most of them are female. It may be that I have worked with many, many women and with fewer men, but I query the women about the men that they're experienced with, and I find that, well, they don't really meet so many who are on a conscious path of either learning how to hold space or healing this inner split, and they're very similar things. But what the thresholder does is hold that space of consistent, unified consciousness, even if only as a temporary example, so that there is one party, or there might be more than one party. It's really wonderful to experience these things with couples in various shades, because that's one of the ways we split off, the mommy-daddy split. For example, is one of them. All right, so that's a little bit of what I have to say in response to that. And the feeling I'm having now, as I listen now for like this fifth or sixth time, is that I am hearing my own ideas reflected back to me in this concise and well thought through way that I've never, ever, ever heard from another teacher. Right? This is not really part of Betty Dodson's work at all. And yet there are, you know, likely to have been other students of hers, all but a couple of whom were female, who have discovered this, but I have not. I have yet to meet them. Okay, let's go for quotation. Have not yet to meet them. There's a few, but I knew them first. Let's put it that way. Okay, so let's go. Quotation number three. Hello, Kelly.
There is something that I observe in men that is, Sayer refers to it as the vagina dentata. Like it's this experience, right, of a woman's passion, her intensity.
It's back to the Medusa thing too, right?
Yeah, it's a bit back to that, right? So it's related for sure. That there is a fear that he will be consumed and obliterated if he aligns with, supports, advocates for, or in other ways leaves his post to go visit her terrain, right? However, if he defends, avoids, dismisses, derides, or in other ways attempts to have some sort of separate but equal agree to disagree, I'll stay over here while you're over there, a woman will never respect that. She will never trust that. And so he loses either way. So there is some experience that I think is becoming available to men that is the sovereign individuation, you know, at impulse at its core, which is to say, I can hold the container for your experience. I can lean in with curiosity, compassion, and interest, and I will be unmoved, you know, in ways that are essential to my core masculine line, right? You can spiral around all you want and need, and I will allow myself to be informed, you know, by your experience. And I've got this no matter what, right? So there is something, you know, again, I'm speaking from a woman's perspective about what it is that I think we want, and it requires the resolution of the projection of the bad mother. And once that happens, like the woman's role would be really to stop telling men what the hell to do. Truly stop. Just stop. Stop knowing better than they do what they need, which we feel we do. And maybe we do, actually. Maybe it's part of our capacity. Maybe it's part of our corpus callosum, you know, being bigger, whatever it is,
right,
that
right.
we are very attuned, you know, to what it is that might be needed next. However, when we occupy that role of director, of general, of contractor, we activate that archetype. And so the way to co-participate, I guess, in the resolution and integration of that bad mommy archetype and its associated painful projection might be that we stop telling men what to do. We allow them to have their experience while focusing on, you know, that submissive energy, that I energy, that feeling energy, and really keeping the focus inward with appropriate expression. So that men can start to recognize that they can navigate by that, right? That there is an experience of that male-female complementarity, masculine-feminine complementarity, where the masculine navigates by the compass of the feminine intuition, perhaps internally, but certainly in partnership. And that is only really made available when these old dynamics of, you know, one person is right and the other is wrong. One person is in power while the other is, you know, helpless. These old dynamics of parity games are resolved, and we come into that complementarity.
Exactly. So much in there. I feel like I could write an entire book based on that paragraph. Let's work backwards again. Yes, women not telling men what to do, and men not telling women what to do. In other words, we don't own each other. We are companions. We are assistants. We are witnesses. But we don't own one another, and we don't control one another. Next. In terms of the like some inherent quality of the nature of men and women, we have to remember a few things. That however it may have happened, women have been subjugated to property for a very long time. However, it is a false statement to say that most men are in any way free or sexually free. They are not. And what men and women do quite a bit of is exercising the illusory prerogative of saying what you can do, which is basically whatever doesn't threaten me, whoever, whatever sex that might be going back and forth from men or women or women and men or whatever. Now, I have seen, experienced, lived, and continue to love and live the astonishing sexual capacity of the female body. And it has occurred to me a great many times that this is actually the nature of the conflict, the nature of the controversy. The astonishing sexual capacity of the female body, meaning the female person, but it has something to do with the female body as a sexual conduit. And there is extreme conditioning against acknowledging this, coming from almost every quarter. But we cannot count out the vicious effects of religion, of feminism, which is the one of the seeds of the idea that women know better than men. I would remind everyone that the original feminists were also the suffragists, were also the abolitionists, i.e. advocating the prohibition of liquor, and that inherent in that movement was the idea that women are inherently more moral than men. We forget this. It is suppressed, it is hidden, it is concealed, it is convoluted, but it is an actual factor in the dynamics between women and men. And it's like, we're lucky if someone puts words to it, right? Because the idea that I could tell my partner what, I'm a woman and I can tell my partner what to do, well, there's an element of moralism in there. What else could it be? It's like, well, you're about to, you know, color in that grass with a blue crayon. Well, who fucking cares? That when we talk about control, we're talking about, oh, men might want to have sexual experiences. Women are inherently more moral. Well, I've never, ever been able to prove that one. And I've been trying a lot. And it has been one of the most painful experiences of my life to realize that women are not the perfect beings that they were thrust on me as I went through an experience of coming of age during second wave feminism, which is the continuation of suffrage, abolitionist, prohibitionist, teetotaling, smashed liquor bottles, women are more moral than men version of feminism. It's just an extension of that. The sexual capacity of women is, I think, the like whale in the room. I've had the opportunity to witness and experience many things that many, nearly all people do not ever get to be near. And in those experiences, I have seen situations where women just emerge as these almost supernatural sexual beings capable of sustained orgasm lasting 45 minutes. For example, Betty Dodson used to joke, Betty Dodson, the great grandmother of masturbation and the leader of the masturbation movement, held a lot of orgies in her apartment on Madison Avenue. And what she would, oh, she said to me several times that the men would be done and watching TV in the other room while the women were still going at it. And the implication that women are more moral than men, or that in the words of Tantra, women provide the wisdom and men provide the means, conceals this sexual capacity and all of the controversy and suppression of women as a result of it. There are very few men who could fuck 50 women in one session. There are many women who could be fucked by 50 men in one session and keep going and keep going and keep going. And I think that this is, while it can be accessible to men, it is much closer to the female reality, and it's not going to happen to any man who's not really in touch with his interior space, with his feminine capacity. Now, in other parts of this interview, Kelly talks about the relationship between yin and yang and dominant and submission. She mentions Kasia Urbaniak, who's been on the program twice, and I texted Kasia last night. She's in Hawaii. And she's got a bit of a cold, so we got as far as we could with the lady being under the weather. But we talked about yin and yang and top, bottom, dom, and sub, and all that. We will come back to that. However, what Kasia said in that discussion is that yin is definitely not sub, and yang is definitely not top, and that yin can very much be dominant. It's just a different approach to being dominant. And putting that aside, in the inner exploration of yin and yang in a person, meaning the assertive and the receptive, the giver and the receiver, there's different ways these dualisms parse out that in the most profound states of masturbation or self-given sex, say, for example, involving penetration, there's part of the intention is to penetrate. Part of the intention is to be penetrated. So there's a lot of yin-yang, inner polarity exploration that can happen. And this is an experience of profound integration, because feelings are being accessed that are generally not accessed at the fruit and vegetable market. But once they are accessed, once one has commenced that integration process, and once one is like with it and, you know, on the journey, then they certainly can be experienced at the fruit and vegetable market, if such a thing even exists anymore. I think, and I'll conclude on this, we need to be conscious of our assessments of male and female capacities, or let's say roles, because of numerous factors acting on the gender prisons that people are put into. And so part of the exploration of yin yang is getting out of your gender prison, and you find out that you've got it all inside of you, and therefore you have the option to express your reality any way that you want. But acting to enforce those gender prisms are religion, feminism, the onslaught of artificial hormones that are soaking society, whether we're talking Roundup, PCBs, DDT, dioxin, the whole plethora of plasticizers, phthalates, all this stuff is creating gender mayhem, hormone mayhem, which is making people think different thoughts and act different ways. The birth control pill masculizes the female brain. And so a great many women have been or are on hormonal birth control, and we're just getting it from the environment, by being around each other, by drinking tap water and all of this stuff. Finally, technology is having an effect on us. And so we need to reorient on ourselves, but this partly means recognizing the things that are enforcing the gender prison. And one of my theories of why this whole LGBTQ thing is so mandatory, like why all white heterosexual people must genuflect when they pass the LGBTQ center, is because it's a projection of the gender exploration and questioning. The Q, that's the most important part of the LGBTQ. No one knows if it's queer or questioning. I prefer to think of it as questioning. In fact, I would stick a question mark behind the whole LGBTQIA thing. Huh? And I have come to observe that this is largely serving as a projection screen for people who are not that interested in doing this. Like, oh, they're doing that. That's good. That man wants to be a woman. That woman wants to be a man. How wonderful. Well, when you start getting into your inner yin-yang exploration, that's kind of genderqueer, right? You're letting go of all the normal, the enforced, let's say, associations, and having this experience. And one more thought on this while we're on men and women. And I was in this conversation with Cheryl, one of my kind of, let's say, study partners in this, talking about it's partly exaltation and partly fetishization and partly respect for female masturbation. Female masturbation, thanks to Betty and Betty alone, who got all these other people going, Carol Queen and everybody else going, is now considered to be a beautiful, worthwhile, loving thing. Male masturbation is generally considered, ew, that's gross. It's, you use terms like jacking off. It doesn't quite have the same real ring as jilling off. That's nice. Jacking off, that's like, that's disgusting. And you know, you imagine the guy with the computer and the magazine. They don't have magazines anymore. But, you know, gratuitously trying to satisfy himself and all this stuff and being told that anything that he might imagine or fantasize about or the content of videos or chatterbait or that's all oppressive and all this crap that is very rarely ever projected onto women. So men and women are in different gender prisons, different style of gender prisons. And one of those things is that there is still an ew factor about male masturbation and about semen that is not a factor in female masturbation. And now what is all the rage, all of a sudden, as if out of nowhere, female ejaculation. Like in the last 15 years, suddenly women ejaculate. It's like, who knew? I mean, some of us do, but that's a beautiful thing. Male ejaculation, not so much. Spunk, get the paper towel, blah, blah, blah. So while this is not 100% true, I think that part of the challenge of men making peace with their bodies and loving their bodies and loving what their bodies do is influenced by these cultural projections of religion, feminism, hormones, and technology that I suspect, because of another cultural standard, women are a little more free from. There's no guys making megabucks on OnlyFans. That's only about women. So you've got men essentially, and some women, but mostly men, worshiping female masturbation, worshiping it. And a lot of men feeling utterly disgusting for masturbating and certainly not being worshipped by women for doing so. This is a frontier. And I will propose that men need the assistance of women who are further along the path of accepting their bodies and making peace with and making love with their bodies and feeling like a complete and whole person, which is challenging, and we may never fully be there. But there are, you know, stages, temporary level stages along this process that women can be very helpful to men. But this really requires that thresholding quality, that space-holding quality. And in my experience, tremendous patience for what is very often the lack of a sense of an interior to physical and emotional space that women have to experience if they are sexually active, because they're getting fucked and they're dealing with their pussies and dealing with the inside of their bodies all the time, where this is generally not a thing happening with, certainly with most heterosexual men. But we have seen this curiosity rise. Like I haven't seen one lately, but the, you know, how many straight men want to be penetrated? And I will say I have noticed that becoming much more of a thing in like, I don't know, 27 or 8 years I've been involved in this as a communal activity, but nowhere near what is considered, you know, acceptable and helpful for women. So this has still got a little, oh my God, it's gay thing going on. So much to say about this. And I am immensely grateful to Saul Luckman for inviting Kelly onto his program and for Kelly's unbelievable cogency in this interview. I'm going to find someone to transcribe this. This is a Kelly's presentation, and this is a sexual teaching for the ages. And when she says she thinks it might be the antidote to all of this, yeah, yes. For reference, by the way, there is a program, scroll down a little bit on the cover of Planet Waves FM, an interview with Tom DiFerdinando about Wilhelm Reich's idea of the emotional plague. All right. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting the program, to all of you who make little, teeny, medium-sized, and huge donations. It all helps keep the lights on and the servers spinning with hundreds of back editions of the program and paying the bookkeeper, who was just here. Let's go out with one more Wilco. I don't think there's anyone who can't relate to this song, but maybe not. This is from a fairly recent 2016, I don't think there's been a Wilco album since, called Schmilko. And the song is If I Ever Was a Child. Thanks for listening. Lots of love to you. And bye for now.
Been alone long enough to know if I ever was a child. I was tied up like a boat, unbuttoned like a coat, set free for a while. Well, I jumped to jolt my clumsy blood. Too much. I'll hold you.